Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is not often understood by Americans, but an incredibly important battlefront in that war is the home front. And I'm not talking about the simple problem that we've all experienced, of course, notably on and after 9/11, of terrorism. I'm talking about the problem of enemies within our country who may not be using violent means to sabotage us or subvert us, but who are using other techniques to accomplish that same goal. A woman who has achieved considerable prominence and been a subject of great controversy since she was elected to the United States House of Representatives for, according to some, these reasons, is Ilhan Omar. She is a representative of a district in Minnesota, but she is also, according to our guest this hour, an American ingrate. That is the title of his book. The subtitle is Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. Its author is Benjamin Weingarten, an extraordinary, relatively young man who I have been proud to get to know and feature on this program, and never been more excited about his contributions to our public policy debate than I am as we help him kick off the introduction to the public and hopefully readers across America of this very important book, American Ingrate. Benjamin Weingarten is a Publius Fellow at the Claremont Institute. He has been, among other things, a senior contributor for some time now to The Federalist, and he is a Robert Novak Fellow at the Fund for American Studies. A lot of accomplishments and most especially great writing can be found in those platforms from Ben Weingarten. Ben, it's so good to have you back. Congratulations on this important new book, and it couldn't be more timely, in my judgment, because as we're watching what's happening now in the aftermath of Super Tuesday yesterday to the Democratic Party, we need to understand the role that people like Ilhan Omar are playing in its transformation beyond recognition. I think you know I worked a long time ago for a marvelous Democratic senator by the name of Henry Scoop Jackson. And I often think of the high RPM spinning in the grave that he must be experiencing at the moment, seeing what's happening to his party. So welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio and giving us a full hour of your time to talk about American ingrate Ilhan Omar and what is, in fact, happening with the progressive Islamist takeover of the Democratic Party. Welcome, sir.
Well, Frank, thanks as always for that most kind introduction. And I think one of the big takeaways of this book is that the Democratic Party is no longer the party of Scoop Jackson or Daniel Patrick Moynihan or John F. Kennedy, for that matter. And that foretells great danger for the country.
It does. And I want to come back to that because this is, of course, something I believe all of us have an interest in, is a true, viable, bipartisan Democratic polity that is in part rooted in shared values and shared commitments, even if there are differences in how they're advanced. But Ben, let's start with who is Ilhan Omar. Introduce her to us. We think we may know something about her, but give us what are the fruits of your important research in this book.
Part of the reason that I wrote this book is because I believe that Ilhan Omar is both symbolically and substantively a powerful representative of the progressive movement that, as I argue, and I think can be demonstrated empirically, and as I demonstrate empirically in the book at great length, is part of this progressive movement that really has taken over the Democratic Party. And you see it, for example, represented in the fact that we have a more left-focused Democratic presidential field on any number of issues than at any time in American history, arguably. You see it in the Democrats' impeachment charade, which were Speaker Pelosi not facing off with the squad, headlined, of course, in part by Ilhan Omar. I don't think it would have been a rational decision at all for her to go through with that process or for others in the Democratic establishment to support it either. And we saw it most cravenly in the cave, specifically to Ilhan Omar, when the Democratic House members refused to censure her by name and specifically for her comments. And that brings us back to Omar and her background. For many Americans, I think their introduction to Omar stems in part from her flippant comments on 9/11 about how some people did something, her invocation of anti-Semitic tropes, her effectively calling Americans deplorable, ignorant, irredeemable, and constantly browbeating and bad-mouthing the country that we love and its core values and institutions. And an American ingrate, I go back and look at what some of Omar's influences were. And what you find, remarkably and sadly, and we can get into this a little bit later.
Before we get there, where did she come from?
Yeah, Frank, she is referenced as a Somali-American, Minnesota, Minneapolis in particular, representative. But in reality, we need to look at her unexplored roots in Somalia. And she grew up in a lap of luxury in Mogadishu under a Marxist Islamist dictatorship in a third world nation. And when I say lap of luxury, I mean that she grew up self-described in a compound replete with servants and ample food such that they could feed the beggars outside of it and education. And what she describes as paradise for everyone else was hell in that country. And the reason that her family was there was precisely because of their position in that regime.
But let me just back this up for 1 second, because her grandfather, as you said, had a senior position in a Marxist, pro-Soviet, communist enterprise, the government of Somalia. So there's another tell as to, you know, not just the privilege, of course, but also the sort of ideological moorings of young Ilhan Omar before she and her family departed the country of Somalia and came to the United States to make a new life for themselves. No?
Yes, and I would suggest that one of the reasons she may be so ungrateful is the fact that she went from the lap of luxury in a Marxist-Islamist utopia from her family's perspective to a Kenyan refugee camp where she describes living under the threat of violence and disease and menial labor to the U.S., and her family has to start at the bottom of the ladder. But she's had such a remarkable rise here from basically nothing as a refugee to the height of power, where she sits now as the co-chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign in Minnesota, where she sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which presents all manner of national security risks, where she put forth a battery of bills recently described by Ben Rhodes as the new progressive baseline for foreign policy.
Ben, we're going to come back to all of these topics in much more detail on the other side of a short break. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour of fascinating conversation and deep insight into a woman who's, well, I think now it's fair to say, become notorious during her relatively short time in public office in the United States House of Representatives. Her name is Ilhan Omar. She represents people from a district in Minnesota that has been heavily populated by fellow Somali expatriates. The author of a new book, American Ingrate, is with us to discuss this woman, Ilhan Omar, her roots, her policy proclivities, And the fact that she is, as he calls his book, an American ingrate. Ben, thank you again for your time. Let's talk a bit about the kinds of policies that Ilhan Omar espouses that emanate from her experiences with the hard left in her native Somalia and her deep attachment to Sharia and the supremacism that it imbues in its followers.
The way I've described her agenda simply is socialism at home and surrender abroad. And this fits perfectly well both in the milieus of Mogadishu and Minneapolis. And as I've argued, Ilhan Omar personifies this sort of progressive Islamist nexus. And you mentioned her district, and I will get to her positions by way of this point. Her district is comprised of, in large part, Somali refugees, as well as, and this was her state representative district where she was first elected, but she still represents today as a member of the House, as well as two college campuses. And it was college students that really pushed her over the top in a hard-fought primary that elevated her into office in the first place. And I think that is a perfect representative of, first of all, the progressive dystopia that she is representing, but second of all, the fact that she seamlessly blends both the worst positions of the progressives and the worst positions of the Islamists. And the glue that holds them together, I would suggest, and this has been true historically as well as today, is anti-Semitism masquerading as anti-Zionism. That is the glue that holds this intersectional alliance together as a starting point. But ultimately, both the Islamist movement and the progressive movements seek to triumph over Judeo-Christian Western civilization as traditionally understood. They believe that we are irredeemable, deplorable. In Ilhan Omar's words, that America is a genocidal project founded on colonialization, exploitation, imperialism, all the sort of buzzwords from the Marxist past. And thus, in their worldview, the only just, moral, righteous, good thing to do is to overthrow all of our core institutions in a revolution. And that's what Bernie Sanders' campaign calls for. She's one of his leading surrogates. And the real stumbling block to the progressive movements, which is expansionist ultimately and imperialist ultimately, as well as the Islamist movements, which seek to dominate, which can brook no dissent, which are totalitarian at core, they align in that they're both totalitarian. And the biggest stumbling block to them is ultimately the Judeo-Christian West. Hence this whole panoply of positions, completely anathema to traditional constitutional American ones from Ilhan Omar.
You said a lot there, and I think the thing that we need to really reflect on carefully here is how deeply hostile to the country that has welcomed her, given her, as you said, Ben, extraordinary amount of, well, not just privilege, but power. And yet her express ambition is to overthrow that government and transform it fundamentally, Barack Obama famously said, through revolution. This is not just ingratitude. This is a loathing that I think needs to be called out. And I am so grateful to you for doing this in your book by not simply invective, but by, you know, the factual documentation of what she's about and aspires to do. Ben, let's talk a bit about the sponsors that Ilhan Omar has in her camp that are protecting her, that are enabling her, that are empowering her in this radical agenda.
Yes. Well, you have the entire Democratic Party, for one, which has essentially caved to her. And as I mentioned, that was sort of best represented in her invocation of anti-Semitic tropes regarding the Israel lobby and her comments about it's all about the Benjamins. And she has never truly shown any contrition for those comments. And the Democratic Party, again, refused to censure her by name directly and her comments specifically.
Worse yet, what they did in that resolution, we should remember, was they sort of equated her anti-Semitism, and it is anti-Semitism, it's not just anti-Zionism, of course, with, you know, Islamophobia as an equal and, you know, even, I think they would say, more serious problem did they not?
It turned punishing her for her clear Jew hatred represented in those comments into an attack on conservatives. That was really the effect of that resolution, because, of course, any criticism of Ilhan Omar is cast as Islamophobic, in spite of the fact that it would be Islamophobic not to hold her to the same standards of scrutiny as everyone else in America. So it was a truly shameful act and a disastrous act by the Democrats. And I think it showed that they would allow Ilhan Omar to act with impunity.
But before we get to something else, let's just stay with this for a moment, Ben Weingarten. Who, in the end, was responsible for the crafting of that resolution and its adoption by the House of Representatives?
Yeah, it was really the progressive forces within the House, and that includes the Squad members, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, members of the Congressional Black Caucus as well.
But was it not ultimately Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who may have had some reluctance initially, but ultimately threw in with those factions? And it's kind of a prime example, is it not, of what you're talking about in terms of the transformation, the takeover of the Democratic Party?
Yeah. Let me state it very clearly in case it wasn't before. The resolution that was originally put up called out Ilhan Omar and called out her comments. By the time we got to the final resolution, it became attacked on conservatives and an act of protecting Ilhan Omar. And that only transpired because the Democratic establishment caved to the progressive forces in their party, as well as the media. And that shows the power of those progressive forces, who Ilhan Omar headlines, who she is a representative of, who she supports, and ultimately who I believe are going to not only transform that party, they're going to fully take it over. It may take several iterations, and we see a battle right now between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. That's one manifestation of it. But long term, all the trends point in their direction, as I detail extensively in American Ingrate.
And in part, Ben, is it not the case that that's due to the radicalization that has taken place in our schools over the years? The younger cohort that is now a voting age, in some cases two or three elections into their political engagement, are increasingly aligned with this unbelievably anti-American and radical socialist agenda, and in the process, more often than not, throwing in with Islamists who may have a different end state in mind than the socialist communists, but share in the near term their desire to overthrow the country that, as I said, has taken Ilhan Omar in and made her who she is today.
There's no question that the anti-American sentiments of national self-loathing, which say that it is virtuous and just, socially just, to overthrow all of our core institutions and trash the country, has dominated in our schools, dominates in our culture, dominates even in our corporate world today. We're seeing with the advent of woke capital. And this move has been reflected most strongly over the last two decades, and in particular, among woke white elites. There's a trend referred to as the Great Awakening, and it's real, reflected in any number of issues. And specifically, it starts with what I would call the canary in the coal mine, or the tip of the spear, in the radical, dramatic move among Democrats, and in particular progressives, against Israel and Jewish people and for the Arabs of Palestine, which, as I argue, is a proxy for a whole host of other issues. But consequently, because the culture has shifted so significantly on the left, and in particular due, as you said, to what has happened in the takeover of our education system by progressives and their long march there over several generations, perfect example of the progressive takeover is in the size of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. When that started in the early 90s, there were six members of the CPC, including Bernie Sanders. Today, there are just under 100 members of the CPC. We've seen a 15-fold increase in one generation, and over 40% of Democrats in the House are members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus today. That shows you the power of this movement politically as a result of the transformation that's been done in our culture, in our schools, and elsewhere.
Okay. So we've got Nancy Pelosi. We've got the Progressive Caucus. We've got the Black Caucus that have been bulwarks, and of course the so-called Squad, of which she is one of the members. that are sponsoring this woman. You mentioned earlier Bernie Sanders and the position that he has given her in his campaign. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, especially in the wake of some success he enjoyed in Super Tuesday.
Yeah, Ilhan Omar is one of Bernie Sanders' chief surrogates. She went out and campaigned for him in Virginia prior to Super Tuesday. She went out and held a rally with him in St. Paul, Minnesota, the day before Super Tuesday. She is the co-chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign in the all-important 2020 state of Minnesota, naturally with someone perfectly aligned with her, Keith Ellison. And she sits atop Bernie Sanders' campaign with others who hold similarly abhorrent views regarding both the United States and also regarding Islamic terrorism, including, among others, Linda Sarsour. And the Sanders campaign perfectly reflects this sort of progressive Islamist alliance that I've been discussing.
This is where we'll begin our next segment, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are continuing this extraordinary conversation with Benjamin Weingarten, a brilliant author, essayist, commentator, fellow with a number of very prestigious organizations and senior contributor to The Federalist. Ben, you just were introducing, and we had to take a short break there, this idea that a woman who has such deep enmity towards our country, who is so ungrateful, as the title of your book, American Ingrate, makes it clear, and so much engaged in not just running us down, but seeking, it would seem, revolution at home. I would say it's not just socialism, as you put it a moment ago, but it is the red-green axis. It is the Islamist agenda, as well as the left's, but also, you know, seeking our defeat elsewhere around the world. Talk about the implications of having such a woman on a very important committee of the United States House of Representatives, namely the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and how she got that gig.
Yeah, let's start with how she got that gig. And what I will suggest here is that it is absolutely devastating and a national security threat that Ilhan Omar sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She was given that seat, it appears, because Nancy Pelosi had to make a deal with progressives, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, in order to be handed the speaker's gavel in this Congress. And part of that deal was putting progressives on important committees of interest to the CPC. And so Ilhan Omar was given a seat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee in spite of her known radicalism, in spite of knowledge of her comments about BDS and other issues in the past, BDS being the terror-tide boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. Democrats knew who she was, but Speaker Pelosi, the first cave of hers was to put Omar on the HFAC. And what is the significance of being on the House Foreign Affairs Committee? Ilhan Omar has access to the most sensitive national security and foreign policy information that a representative can have. Yet, if one were to look at just the alleged criminality and documented corruption in her background, which we haven't even got into, that alone would stop her from ever receiving a security clearance in the first place. But what makes this all the more dangerous is, as you noted, the fact that she supports a policy agenda that is about appeasing our adversaries, punishing America, cutting our military down to size, as she calls it, demilitarization, and again, supporting all of our worst adversaries, and all while she is closely tied to, and by closely tied, I mean, speaks in front of, receives money from, receives endorsements from, works on legislation with Islamist groups, domestic, some of them terror-tied, including unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terrorism financing case in U.S. history, CARE.
That would be the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE.
Yes, that's probably the group with which she has the deepest ties, as I document on the book. And as I note, she's received speaking fees from them, campaign contributions from their members, spoken in front of them on any number of occasions. They've worked on pushing legislation, endorsements, all manner of ties and connections. And in a time where we talk about collusion, this is someone who's colluding with an entity in care that in the past, the FBI has said government authorities need to cease all ties with.
Not least because of its relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, whose mission, we're told by one of their senior members, is, quote, destroying Western civilization from within, unquote.
Yes, and as I talk about in the book, when she made the comments about September 11th at CARE's Los Angeles banquet, she was delivering those comments and being introduced in part by the executive director there, who himself was supporting Hussam Ailush, who your listeners may or may not be familiar with, who himself, it was reported, was seeking to raise funds for the Holy Land Foundation prior to 9/11. And of course, post 9/11, CARE had a fundraising button on their website for the Holy Land Foundation, which ultimately was the group that was proven to be a fundraiser for Hamas, and which is the key link of CARE to Hamas and led them to be in part an unindicted co-conspirator in that terrorist financing case. But then there are Omar's ties to foreign Islamists as well. And I know we're packing a lot in here. So I wrote an op-ed last week which details just the tip of the iceberg in terms of her ties to Erdogan and the Turkish regime. And in this New York Post op-ed, as I mentioned, curiously, Erdogan, the head of state of a purported NATO ally, an ally in name but not in practice, met with Ilhan Omar when she was a mere Minnesota state representative in 2017 on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. And as I show, that was the first of many meetings between Turkish officials and Ilhan Omar. And you have to ask, why were they cultivating this relationship? And we have seen the fruits borne out, and not just in terms of the meetings that they've had and Ilhan Omar saying favorable things about the Turkish government, but in terms of her own actions. Just prior to the resolution last year brought to Congress, which put the Armenian genocide at the hands of, recognized that the Armenian genocide was perpetrated by the Ottoman Turks, which the Turkish government finds to be a disastrous PR campaign against them. A lobbyist, purportedly Erdogan's cousin, had cut a $1,500 campaign contribution to Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar is, I believe, the only member of the House not to vote in favor of that resolution, a widely supported bipartisan resolution. So she takes the Turk side with respect to recognizing the Armenian genocide was at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. And then she votes against sanctions on Turkey for their incursion into northern Syria against the Kurds, which again, sanctions which had mass bipartisan support. So Turkey has gotten what they paid for in cultivating this relationship with Omar. Now, why that relationship exists, in part, I believe, and as I document in the book, is because of Turkey's close relations with Somalia, their number one bilateral trade partner, I believe, and certainly their biggest backer. That alone should give us substantial pause about where Congresswoman Omar's sympathies lie while she sits, again, at the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And this is not even to go into her ties to a corrupt, terrorism-ridden Somali regime as well, where her ties at senior levels are even deeper, probably, than with the Turks, as I document in the book.
All right, so let's just recap. You have a woman who is deeply hostile to the United States, despite all it's done for her, sitting in a position where she has access to highly classified information. Our colleague Trevor Loudon, who has written the book and produced a movie entitled The Enemy Within, that documents the deep penetration of our Congress and other governing bodies by Islamists and leftists. And she is kind of the perfect example of the combination of the two. He says that members of Congress, none of them, actually is subjected to a background investigation. They aren't forced to go through the normal clearing process by government agencies, because they're entitled to classified information simply by virtue of getting elected. And he says that people like Ilhan Omar couldn't pass the background check requirements to drive a school bus in the United States, let alone have the run of secret information about our military capabilities, our diplomatic personnel and practices and the like. This is staggering national security problem, it seems to me, Ben Weingarten, and I commend you for elevating it, especially by tying in the deeply problematic character of the Turkish government under Recep Tayyip Erdogan. As you say, no longer an ally in any name. I mean, heaven's sakes, we're watching Erdogan as we speak, trying to break down the doors of Europe once more to flood it with millions, perhaps, of fellow Sharia supremacists, so-called refugees, so-called, in fact, legal immigrants. But Ben, I just want to take another moment to talk about Turkey, because Turkey these days, as I understand it, is now the prime sponsor in the United States of the Muslim Brotherhood. This mosque, the largest in the eastern part of the United States, in Maryland, is it's called the Dayanet, which is an arm of the Turkish government. And it's being used, I feel strongly, to not only conduct influence operations. Yes, of course, there's sort of the coloration that there's a religious character to this operation. But frankly, it is an arm of Turkish imperialism and its deep hostility to our country, which, of course, Ilhan Omar certainly shares. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, Erdogan, certainly, it is well documented, is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots. And those offshoots include, of course, Hamas and other jihadist groups as well. Erdogan, as you noted, has completed his transition from, at least purportedly, an Ataturkian, consistent with Turkey's past sort of strongman, to today an Islamist tyrant. And it's very clear, based upon his rhetoric and his policies as well, that Erdogan sees himself as a would-be caliph, the dominant leader in the Sunni Islamic world and probably in the Islamic world writ large. To your point, Turkey has extended substantial efforts, resources, they put in a ton of time to this project of building up their ties within the Muslim community in America, and also seeking to influence our political system as well. And what I talk about in the book are Erdogan and the Turkish regime's ties to the Council on American Islamic Relations and the USCMO, the U.S. Council on Muslim Organizations, which is the umbrella organization under which CARE and other Muslim Brotherhood tied American Islamic groups sit. And Erdogan has extended substantial efforts to cultivate ties with these groups.
We will return with Benjamin Weingarten right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily interesting, important, frightening, and timely conversation with the author of American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party, Benjamin Weingarten. And Ben, you were just talking a bit about Turkey and its role, a hostile power, albeit one that continues to be called an ally. It simply is no longer one by any reasonable standard. And its interest in helping spread Sharia worldwide, and the degree to which it has found in the person of Ilhan Omar, but in others, Muslims like Rashida Tlaib in the Congress and non-Muslims in the Progressive Caucus and the Black Caucus and others who are evidently not only prepared to provide cover for Ilhan Omar, to protect her, to apologize maybe, but nonetheless to align themselves with her, but are equally determined, it seems, to recruit more of her people with her kinds of predilections and policy priorities to the Congress, and for that matter, a lot of positions down ballot. Talk a bit about that, and if you can, the role that the Turks are playing in it, but also just the Democratic party leadership itself.
Yeah, it's sort of a perfect storm. And let me start on the Democratic half of this, which is that Muslim Americans for Democrats represent a likely growth industry in terms of votes. If you look at the polling numbers, Muslims tend to support left positions on about 2/3 of issues, and they identify around 70% Democrats based on the latest information. Also, Muslims represent the sort of perfect intersectional, multiculturalist sort of vision that Democrats have for their party in terms of checking all the boxes, in terms of the victimization hierarchy that they have created. And then you also have the fact that the Muslim population in America is growing at a substantial rate. So politically, from the Democrats' perspective, they view Muslims as votes that they ought to really fight hard for. And as such, you've seen more substantial outreach to Muslim American groups, including by Bernie Sanders and others, during this campaign than we've seen before. And we've also seen progressive, in terms of their political philosophy, Muslim groups in the U.S. seeking to recruit more and more candidates and put up more and more candidates for spots. So what I would sort of suggest is that there's a perfect storm of both the Islamists, who themselves are trying to promote their agenda here by putting up Islamist-friendly candidates. And then at the same time, you have this intersection with the Democratic Party, which sees Muslims, just from a purely cynical political perspective, as a huge potential vote and power base for them, both given their ideological predilections and otherwise. And thus, it's obvious that you're going to see more and more Muslim candidates running, as you said, up and down candidates, favorable towards the types of views that are supported by CARE and other groups as well, because for the Democrats, it's a political calculation, and for the Islamists, it's an ideological imperative.
Yeah. A guy who has been very much at the forefront, the vanguard, if you will, of this red-green axis for years is Ilhan Omar's co-chair for Bernie Sanders in Minnesota. You mentioned him earlier. Former congressman, now Attorney General of Minnesota, Keith Ellison. My recollection has been that Keith Ellison said when he was chairman of the House Progressive Caucus a term or two ago that it was his purpose, which he subsequently worked hard at as the co-chairman of the Democratic National Committee as well, was to double the size of the Muslim caucus in the House of Representatives every election cycle. So when you look at what Ilhan Omar is doing, when you look at what Keith Ellison is doing, when you look at what the Muslim Brotherhood-tied groups like CARE are doing, when you look at what the Turks are helping to bring about, what is likely to be, Ben, the cumulative impact of all of that on one of the two major parties in our country and the kind of political discourse, if you will, that we're likely to have going forward?
Ultimately, and this is in part the reason that I wrote this book, it would be a disaster for the country if anti-American radicals of the progressive, of the Islamist, or of the jointly progressive Islamist persuasion dominate that party. As you opened today's episode by talking about the fact that we need to have shared values and principles, even if we have opposing political views, to keep a country together. Ultimately, we don't have a country if the party representing about half of our citizens is at the throat of the country itself, is opposed to it, is hostile to it, has a view of national self-loathing, anti-Americanism, support for our worst adversaries to somehow account for our sins and the evil in our background. And so part of the reason that I wrote this book is that Ilhan Omar is the perfect representative of what happens when a party begins to give in to an ethos of national self-loathing. And the country will not be long for the world in any sort of recognizable form if these individuals and their acolytes fully complete their takeover of a party representing half the country. And as I argue in the book, the signs are there that they are more than poised to do so. It may not happen this election cycle, but all the trends are pointing towards the Democratic Party moving much further left. And each subsequent generation seems to be more radical than the prior one. And look, Ilhan Omar herself, if you want to look at, you mentioned Keith Ellison and Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar was Keith Ellison's successor. He created that seat and that space for her. He left that position, became state attorney general, and Ilhan Omar filled that position. Perfect representative of what happens when you go from radical to even more radical. And that's where the Democratic Party is today and appears to be going.
Yeah. Ben Weingarten, let's leave this with a prescription. What can be done to try to protect our country from their agenda and where they would take it?
Well, Frank, to build on your last point and just to make this threat to all of our liberties real, if we lose the First Amendment, we will lose ultimately all of the other amendments. And so this book in part was an expression of my First Amendment rights to speak out and educate people on this issue. But just to build on your last point, within days, a few days of this book coming out, Ilhan Omar's team, her campaign team, put out a fundraising call saying that this book, and me specifically as a person, intended to incite violence by printing this book. Now, I did nothing of that sort, and the fact that they would slander me like that is an illustration of the fact that they want to scare all of us who speak freely and openly and look at the facts wherever they lead us into submission. So the first thing is we have to speak openly and honestly and not give in to thuggish third world sort of behavior in this country. It's intolerable not to tolerate free speech, and we cannot cow and submit to them and act in a craven fashion, because then there is no dissent and then they win.
All of this is so appreciated, Ben, as is your courage in bringing this information to the fore. I know you'll keep it up. I hope you'll come back to us very soon. In the meantime, keep up the good work. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.